black paint. To replicate how hard it is to see in a real fire, our instructor said. I looked out at the growing blaze in front of us. This fake fire seemed plenty real to me. I put on my mask. I couldn't see a thing. The firefighters yelled our instructions over the roar of the flames. There is a dummy trapped in the middle of the maze. Your goal is to rescue him as quickly as possible. In a real fire, in a strange home, it is exceedingly easy to get lost and disoriented. The only way to avoid this is to keep in constant contact with the wall. You will enter the building in teams of two, holding on to one another, so one of you can hold on to the wall while the other sweeps the floor for the dummy. This task would be nearly impossible alone, but working with a partner, it could be done fairly easily. The firefighters assured us that the whole task should take only 7 to 10 minutes, but that we had a whole hour of oxygen in our tanks just in case. An alarm bell would alert us when we were down to our final 5 minutes of air, giving us plenty of time to exit safely. Finally, the firefighters reminded us again of our human lifelines, our partners. In a fire, it might seem counterintuitive to hold on to your teammate, but that was the best way of getting out alive. The veterans flung open the door, and we crawled headfirst into the inferno. I started gulping oxygen, and I could feel my partner grip my jacket at the wrist and hear him breathing just as hard. We started timidly feeling our way through the smoke. He went first, keeping a hand on the wall, while I held onto him with one hand and used the other to feel along the floor for the dummy. About 10 minutes into the maze, everything seemed to be going fine, except for the fact that we couldn't see and felt moments away from heatstroke. But we still hadn't found the dummy. That's when I heard the bell. Surrounded by flames and smoke, blind, and crawling around on my knees, I tried to make sense of what was happening. Why was the alarm on my partner's air tank going off? There had to be at least 45 minutes of oxygen left, yet the bell meant he had only 5 minutes of air to go. Must be some kind of mistake, I thought. Then my bell went off. Veteran firefighters would have remained calm. We panicked. Our ability to reason vanished. I unthinkingly let go of my partner, and then he let go of the wall, which meant the worst. We were both alone, and we had both lost the way back out. Disoriented and frightened, we flailed blindly in opposite directions, groping the air and calling each other's name. But I couldn't hear him over the roar of the fire, and was sure he couldn't hear me either. As the minutes ticked by, I began to feel increasingly helpless and scared. I crawled around frantically, sure that my oxygen supply was rapidly running out. Finally, after what seemed like an eternity, I felt the heat recede as a pair of strong arms dragged me out of the maze into safety. As I gulped in the fresh air, the veterans revealed several things. First, everything that had gone wrong had been part of the training. The bells on the tanks were set to go off early, raising the false alarm that we were out of air. Second, when the firefighters went in after us, they had found me crawling around in circles at a dead end, and my partner, 20 feet away, equally lost and doing more or less the same thing. Third, there had been no dummy. As the firefighters like to say at the end of training every year, the only dummies in the fire are the newbies, and they always have to be saved. At the time, I remember thinking that this was a particularly cruel trick. But years later, I'm impressed at how memorably the fire maze training instilled in me the lesson that is at the heart of Principle 7. That when we encounter an unexpected challenge or threat, the only way to save ourselves is to hold on tight to the people around us and not let go. The mistake we make. This principle is just as true in the modern workplace as it is in the fiery smoke tank. In the midst of challenges and stress at work, nothing is more crucial to our success than holding on to the people around us. Yet when the alarm bells at work go off, all too often we become blind to this reality and try to go it alone. And as a result, we end up like I did, circling helplessly at some dead-end corner until we run out of air. I've seen too many businessmen and women fall prey to this miscalculation. I can remember hearing the trading bell ring at the end of one particularly vicious day in November of 2008. The Dow was way down. Countless sums of money had been lost. I watched as swarms of traders loosened their ties and walked dejectedly off the floor. But what struck me was that they didn't retreat to the stronghold of their teams as they normally did after a day of trading. They all walked off silent and alone. These were smart, capable people with MBAs from some of the world's leading institutions. Yet in a situation that required them to be firing on all cylinders, they were actively undercutting themselves. At the very time that they needed one another the most, they were foregoing their most valuable resource, their social support. Time and again during those perilous months, I saw companies jettison team trainings and social perks, ignoring plummeting team morale in favor of things deemed more important. But in fact, nothing was more important than what they were letting go of. We don't have to go to the brink of a collapsing economy to understand how easy it is to retreat into our own shells at the moment we need to be reaching out to others the most. We've all been there sometime or another. A daunting project gets dropped on our desk, and we get consumed with worry that we'll fail to meet the demands. Is there enough time to get it all done? What will happen if we don't? As the deadline looms and the pressure mounts, we start eating lunch at our desks, working late, coming in on weekends. Soon we're focused like a laser, or so we tell ourselves, which means no FaceTime with direct reports, no casual hallway chats, no time even for non-essential calls with clients. Even our emails are more brusque and impersonal. As for time with family and friends, well, these things are the first to go when we're in crisis mode. But even though we're giving work our undivided attention, our productivity is declining. And as the deadline nears, our goal seems to be slipping further and further out of reach. And so we hunker down, shut off our cell phones, retreat into the bunker of ourselves, and double lock the door. One of two things usually happens at this juncture. Either we falter and fail to finish the project, or we power through it and get it done, then immediately get rewarded with another challenging project, though we now have zero oxygen left in our tank. Either way, we're not only miserable, dejected, and overwhelmed, but lost in a dead end, unable to perform, and all alone. The most successful people take the exact opposite approach. Instead of turning inward, they actually hold tighter to their social support. Instead of divesting, they invest. Not only are these people happier, but they are more productive, engaged, energetic, and resilient. They know that their social relationships are the single greatest investment they can make in the happiness advantage. Investing in the happiness advantage. One of the longest-running psychology studies of all time, the Harvard Men's Study, followed 268 men from their entrance into college in the late 1930s all the way through the present day. From this wealth of data, scientists have been able to identify the life circumstances and personal characteristics that distinguish the happiest, fullest lives from the least successful ones. In the summer of 2009, George Valiant, the psychologist who has directed the study for the last 40 years, told the Atlantic Monthly that he could sum up the findings in one word. Love, full stop. Could it really be so simple? Valiant wrote his own follow-up article that analyzed the data in great detail, and his conclusions proved the same, that there are 70 years of evidence that our relationships with other people matter, and matter more than anything else in the world. This study's findings have been duplicated time and again. In their book, Happiness, psychologists Ed Diener and Robert Biswas Diener review the massive amount of cross-cultural research that has been conducted on happiness over the last few decades, and they conclude that like food and air, we seem to need social relationships to thrive. That's because when we have a community of people we can count on, spouse, family, friends, colleagues, we multiply our emotional, intellectual, and physical resources. we bounce back from setbacks faster, accomplish more, and feel a greater sense of purpose. Furthermore, the effect on our happiness, and therefore on our ability to profit from the happiness advantage, is both immediate and long-lasting. First, social interactions jolt us with positivity in the moment. Then, each of these single connections strengthens a relationship over time, which raises our happiness baseline permanently. So when a colleague stops you in the hallway at work to say hello and ask about your day, the brief interaction actually sparks a continual upward spiral of happiness and its inherent rewards. Positive outliers already know this to be true. Indeed, it's what makes them positive outliers. In a study, appropriately titled Very Happy People, researchers sought out the characteristics of the happiest 10% among us. Do they all live in warm climates? Are they all wealthy? Are they all physically fit? Turns out, there was one, and only one, characteristic that distinguished the happiest 10% from everybody else. The strength of their social relationships. My empirical study of well-being among 1,600 Harvard undergraduates found a similar result. Social support was a far greater predictor of happiness than any other factor, more than GPA, family income, SAT scores, age, gender, or race. In fact, the correlation between social support and happiness was 0.7. This may not sound like a big number, but for researchers, it's huge. Most psychology findings are considered significant when they hit 0.3. The point is, the more social support you have, the happier you are. And as we know, the happier you are, the more advantages you accrue in nearly every domain of life. Surviving and thriving with social investment. Our need for social support isn't just in our heads. Evolutionary psychologists explain that the innate need to affiliate and form social bonds has been literally wired into our biology. When we make a positive social connection, the pleasure-induced hormone oxytocin is released into our bloodstream, immediately reducing anxiety and improving concentration and focus. Each social connection also bolsters our cardiovascular, neuroendocrine, and immune systems, so that the more connections we make over time, the better we function. We have such a biological need for social support, our bodies can literally malfunction without it. For instance, lack of social contact can add 30 points to an adult's blood pressure reading. In his seminal book, Loneliness, University of Chicago psychologist John Cacioppo compiled more than 30 years' worth of research to convincingly show that a dearth of social connections is actually just as deadly as certain diseases. Naturally, it causes psychological harm as well. It shouldn't surprise you that a national survey of 24,000 workers found that men and women with few social ties were 2 to 3 times more likely to suffer from major depression than people with strong social bonds. When we enjoy strong social support, on the other hand, we can accomplish impressive feats of resilience and even extend the length of our lives. One study found that people who received emotional support during the 6 months after a heart attack were 3 times more likely to survive. Another found that participating in a breast cancer support group actually doubled women's life expectancy post-surgery. In fact, researchers have found that social support has as much effect on life expectancy as smoking, high blood pressure, obesity, and regular physical activity. As one set of doctors put it, when launching a life raft, the prudent survivalist will not toss food overboard while retaining the deck furniture. If somebody must jettison a part of life, time with a mate should be last on the list. He needs that connection to live. When set adrift, it seems those of us who hold on to our raft mates, not just our rafts, are the ones who will stay afloat. Social capital as stress relief. The same strategy, hold on to others, is just as crucial for our survival as we navigate the daily stresses of the working world. Studies show that each positive interaction employees have during the course of the workday actually helps return the cardiovascular system back to resting levels, a benefit often termed work recovery. And that over the long haul, employees with more of these interactions become protected from the negative effects of job strain. Each connection also lowers levels of cortisol, a hormone related to stress, which helps employees recover faster from work-related stress and makes them better prepared to handle it in the future. Furthermore, studies have found that people with strong relationships are less likely to perceive situations as stressful in the first place. So in essence, investing in social connections means that you'll find it easier to interpret adversity as a path to growth and opportunity. And when you do have to experience the stress, you'll bounce back from it faster and better protected against its long-term negative effects. In the volatile world of work, this ability to manage stress, both physically and psychologically, is a significant competitive advantage. For one, it has been found to greatly reduce a company's healthcare costs and rate of absenteeism. But perhaps more important, it directly impacts individual performance. Researchers have found the physiological resourcefulness that employees gain from positive social interactions provides a foundation for workplace engagement. Employees can work for longer hours, with increased focus, and under more difficult conditions. For instance, when AT&T was suffering massive layoffs and internal turmoil after being split into three separate companies, one senior leader working daily in the trenches noticed that certain employees were faring better under the pressure than others. As he commented to Harvard professor Daniel Goleman, the pain is not being felt everywhere. In a lot of the tech units, where people work in tight teams and where they find great meaning in what they do together, they're fairly impervious to the turmoil. Why? Because individuals who invest in their social support systems are simply better equipped to thrive in even the most difficult circumstances, while those who withdraw from the people around them effectively cut off every line of protection they have available at the very moment they need them most. To fully understand the importance of this distinction and the consequences it has for our future success, let's take a quick trip to the gridiron. All I Need to Know, I Learned from the National Football League. In the world of American football, a few positions get virtually all the attention. Quarterbacks, wide receivers, and star running backs. They're the ones who grab most of the headlines, and their paychecks and fame are testament to their importance. But another group of football players is equally highly paid, and perhaps even more valued. The offensive line. And yet very few people know who they are or what they do. Almost no fans walk around wearing their jerseys, but they should. When a football team lines up on the field, the quarterback stands behind a line of five oversized human beings crouched down on the turf. This is the offensive line. Just inches away from them awaits the opposing team, ready to pounce. At the sound of the whistle, massive muscled bodies come flying forward, using every ounce of their weight and strength to rush the quarterback and smash him to the ground. The offensive line is the only thing standing between the quarterback and this charging mass of humanity. They don't score touchdowns. They don't kick field goals. They only have one job: protect the quarterback. But it is the most important job on the football field. After all, you can't win a football game if the quarterback is flat on his back before he ever has time to throw. When Hall of Fame quarterback Joe Montana first had the privilege of playing behind a really superb offensive line, he excelled like never before. As Michael Lewis writes in the book The Blind Side, Montana played like a kid who'd been given the answers to the test in advance. After the game, Montana told reporters, "I'd never seen us execute like that. That's why it didn't look tough for us, but it was. Our line was stopping them, and when I got that time, things became easy." Everyone credited Joe Montana, but he credited his offensive line. Even though most of us live far removed from the football field, we each have our own version of an offensive line, our spouses, our families, and our friends. Surrounded by these people, big challenges feel more manageable, and small challenges don't even register on the radar. Just as the offensive line protects a quarterback from a particularly brutal sack, our social support prevents stress from knocking us down and getting in the way of our achieving our goals. And just as the offensive line helped Montana throw a touchdown that would have been otherwise impossible, our social ties help us capitalize on our own particular strengths to accomplish more in our work and in our lives. These benefits aren't confined to the short term either. In a longitudinal study of men over the age of 50, those with a high rate of stressful life experiences suffered from a far higher rate of mortality over the next 7 years. But the same study found that this higher rate of mortality held true for everyone except the men who said that they had high levels of emotional support. Like a quarterback who has been protected from sacks his whole career, a lifetime of strong social relationships provides crucial protection against the dangerous effects of stress. We can't always stop the 350-pound lineman flying at us, but we can all invest in a strong offensive line, and that can make all the difference. They excel with a little help from their friends. Unfortunately, not everyone makes this investment. Often the misguided urge to turn inward starts even before we enter the working world. You'll recall that as an officer of Harvard, I spent 12 years living in a dorm with undergraduates. While this afforded me many unique life experiences I wouldn't recommend, like going 12 years eating all my meals on trays, one of the best parts of being in the trenches was having the chance to see the different strategies these 18 to 22-year-olds devised to help them find their way through the maze of Harvard. Though every one of these students was exceptional in one way or another, when it came to handling the inevitable stresses of such a challenging and competitive environment, year after year, I noticed that certain students had a significant leg up, while others, despite all their intelligence and efforts, seemed to sabotage their own forward progress. Two freshmen in particular stand out in my memory, Amanda and Brittany. They were roommates, both had spirited personalities, and both made friends quickly and effortlessly that first September. But as midterms approached, their paths began to diverge. As the pressure mounted, Amanda found a secluded cubicle in the library and spent most of her days and nights there. She started skipping our dorm study breaks. She didn't have time for frivolous activities like sharing snacks and stories with her classmates. Once an active member of our dorm's ultimate frisbee team, she stopped coming to practices and games. When I finally caught up with her one day in the dining hall, as she was taking her lunch to go, most likely back to the library, she admitted that she was just too stressed to focus on anything else but her schoolwork. "My friends will understand," she said. It wasn't her friends I was worried about. Meanwhile, Brittany was flourishing. She wasn't oblivious to the challenges or pressures. She wasn't working any less hard than Amanda. But instead of quarantining herself in a cubicle, she was organizing study groups. For her Magic of Numbers class, note course title not made up, she emailed a group of six friends and had each person write a summary of 1 week's readings. And then they convened at lunch a few times a week to share their work. I remember I once stumbled on one of these sessions, only to find them talking about The Simpsons. I thought that this was a math study group, I asked in mock exasperation. One young man looked up at me, then pointed at Brittany. "We were ordered to make time for small talk," he said. When I checked in with her at a study break a few weeks later, where she was taking 10 minutes off from homework to join our Oreo eating contest, Brittany just shrugged her shoulders. "It's a lot of work, but I don't know. I guess it's just nice to know we're pulling an all-nighter together." I won't belabor the point here, but let's just say that by January, one of these students had succumbed to the pressure and stress and was wishing she could transfer to someplace less competitive. The other was happy, well-adjusted, and performing exceptionally in her courses. While Amanda and Brittany are real people, they also represent the choices each of us has when faced with adversity. Many business leaders I encounter believe, just as Amanda did, that the road to success is one they have to travel alone. But this simply isn't the case. The most successful people I've worked with know that even in an extraordinarily competitive environment, we are more equipped to handle challenges and obstacles when we pool the resources of those around us and capitalize on even the smallest moments we spend interacting with others. Every time Brittany had lunch or a study session with her friends, she wasn't just having a good time. She was decreasing her stress level, priming her brain for high performance, and capitalizing on the ideas, energy, and motivation that social support provides. While Amanda was divesting from her network and floundering as a result, Brittany was investing in something that continually paid dividends. Just as social support is a prescription for happiness and an antidote to stress, it is also a prime contributor of achievement in the workplace. Investing in high performance. We learned in Principle 5, the Zorro Circle, that those of us who believe we have control over the outcome of our fates have a huge advantage in work and in life. This fact can't be denied, but it also doesn't mean we have to exist in a vacuum or that our success hinges on our efforts alone. Remember the 70-year-long Harvard Men's Study? Researchers found that social bonds weren't just predictive of overall happiness, but also of eventual career achievement, occupational success, and income. This truth is sometimes still difficult for many of us to accept, given how deep the ethic of individualism runs in our culture. After all, reading Ralph Waldo Emerson's essay Self-Reliance is practically an American rite of passage. We are particularly independent-minded when it comes to assigning credit for achievements. Stanford psychologist Carol Dweck likes to illustrate the folly of this belief by asking her students to describe how they picture history's greatest minds at work. When you think of Thomas Edison, she asks them, what do you see? He's standing in a white coat in a lab-type room, comes the average reply. He's leaning over a light bulb. Suddenly, it works. Is he alone? Dweck asks. Yes. He's kind of a reclusive guy who likes to tinker on his own. As Dweck relishes in pointing out, this couldn't be further from the truth. Edison actually thrived in group settings. And when he invented the light bulb, he did so with the help of 30 assistants. Edison was actually a social creative, not a lone wolf. And when it comes to society's most innovative thinkers, so often assumed to be eccentric, solitary geniuses, he was not the exception to the rule. We've all heard the popular maxim, two heads are better than one, but the benefits of social interaction in the workplace go far beyond group brainstorming. Having people we can count on for support in the office, even having people we can talk to about last night's Lost episode, actually fuels individual innovation, creativity, and productivity. For instance, one study of 212 employees found that social connections at work predicted more individual learning behavior, which means that the more socially connected employees felt, the more they took the time to figure out ways to improve their own efficiency or their own skill set. Perhaps most important, social connections motivate. When over 1,000 highly successful professional men and women were interviewed as they approached retirement and asked what had motivated them the most throughout their careers, overwhelmingly, they placed work friendships above both financial gain and individual status. In Good to Great, Jim Collins illuminated a similar truth. The people we interviewed from good to great companies clearly loved what they did largely because they loved who they did it with. The better we feel about these workplace relationships, the more effective we will be. For example, a study of over 350 employees in 60 business units at a financial services company found that the greatest predictor of a team's achievement was how the members felt about one another. This is especially important for managers because while they often have little control over the backgrounds or skill sets of employees placed on their teams, they do have control over the level of interaction and rapport. Studies show that the more team members are encouraged to socialize and interact face-to-face, the more engaged they feel, the more energy they have, and the longer they can stay focused on a task. In short, the more the team members invest in their social cohesion, the better the results of their work. High-quality connections. To make a difference to work performance and job satisfaction, social contact need not always be deep to be effective. Organizational psychologists have found that even brief encounters can form high-quality connections, which fuel openness, energy, and authenticity among coworkers, and in turn, lead to a whole host of measurable, tangible gains in performance. Jane Dutton, a psychologist who specializes in this subject at the University of Michigan Business School, explains that any point of contact with another person can potentially be a high-quality connection. One conversation, one email exchange, one moment of connecting in a meeting can infuse both participants with a greater sense of vitality, giving them a bounce in their steps and a greater capacity to act. Again, this isn't just in the interests of having a fun, friendly workplace, though that is an important bonus. Each one of these social connections pays dividends. At IBM, for example, when MIT researchers spent an entire year following 2,600 employees, observing their social ties, even using mathematical formulas to analyze the size and scope of their address books and buddy lists, they found that the more socially connected the IBM employees were, the better they performed. They could even quantify the difference. On average, every email contact was worth an added $948 in revenue. There, in black and white, is the power of social investment. And IBM wisely decided to capitalize on it by starting a program at its Cambridge, Massachusetts office to facilitate the introductions of employees who didn't yet know one another. Google is perhaps the most famous example of a company that truly understands the importance of social connections. This isn't just lip service. Google reflects this understanding in their practices. Not only do company cafeterias stay open well past the hours of the traditional workday, making it easy for employees to dine together as much as possible, Google employees have access to on-site daycare and are even encouraged to make time to visit their kids throughout the day. UPS is another successful company that has invested in social capital. Every day in cities and towns across the country, you can find 3 or 4 local UPS trucks parked together as their drivers sit nearby eating lunch. They swap stories, information, and misplaced packages. Given that this practice takes the drivers off their scheduled routes and takes more time than a solitary lunch would, many people are surprised that the UPS brass, so obsessed with efficiency, would encourage the practice. But they do. They know that this social interaction pays out in the long run, not just for the individual drivers, but for the organization as a whole. Other companies like Southwest Airlines, Domino's Pizza, and The Limited have set up programs that foster social investment, literally, by allowing employees to donate money to colleagues confronted with medical and financial emergencies. The result is that the employees involved, and even those who aren't, but simply know that the program is there, feel a greater commitment to one another and also to the company as a whole. At one Fortune 500 retail organization, a manager shared his reaction to their Employee Support Foundation. "I have a sense of pride in the company. I think it's good to give and, you know, it definitely makes me feel that I'm working for a company that shares in some of my sensibilities and cares about people." These feelings then translate into real dividends, including lower absenteeism and turnover rates, and increased employee motivation and engagement. Glue guys. Of course, sweeping corporate policies like these aren't always necessary. Small differences can have just as much of an impact. Once, on a visit to the London offices of financial giant UBS, I learned it was a weekly tradition for the traders to gather around a beer cart on Friday afternoon. A few years ago, the dean of Harvard Law School had similar ideas about improving the quality of life for her overstressed law students. She set up coffee stations between classrooms and a volleyball court in the yard so that students could find ways to socialize, even if just for a few minutes, between grueling classes. Sadly, these policies are often the first to go when companies find themselves in financial straits. Another example of our tendency to divest when the going gets tough. UBS recently suspended its weekly beer cart because of budget constraints. But thanks to the cohesive culture the tradition had helped create, it lived on. When I last visited the office, employees couldn't wait to tell me about how two managers had dipped into their own lightened pockets to buy beer for their teams. They knew that preserving this ritual would go a long way towards boosting morale, especially during that difficult time. If the mood of their employees when I visited was any indication, it worked. The people who actively invest in their relationships are the heart and soul of a thriving organization, the force that drives their teams forward. In sports, these people are called glue guys. As the Wall Street Journal has explained, this type of player quietly holds winning teams together. Statisticians don't buy that they exist, but psychologists do, and players and managers swear by them. Given that a baseball team spends a minimum of 81 games a year on the road, playing and living together, the importance of getting along shouldn't be too surprising. In the high-stakes environment of professional sports, teams can disintegrate in a hurry under the pressure. Glue guys keep players stuck together at these tough moments when it is most tempting to let go. The Vertical Couple. In one of my favorite episodes of the wickedly satirical sitcom The Office, Stanley, a grumpy employee with no patience for his bumbling boss's antics, has been ordered by his doctor to wear a heart monitor to work. He's recently had some heart trouble, and the monitor will warn him if his heart rate rises to a dangerous level. Enter Michael Scott, poster child for disastrously inept bosses everywhere. Every time Michael wanders within 2 feet of Stanley, the heart monitor goes off, and the closer Michael gets, the louder and more uncontrollably it beeps. Mere proximity to his incompetent and irritating boss causes Stanley's heart rate to skyrocket. Of course, this is a plot of a television show, but it's actually not as removed from reality as it sounds. Back in the real world, a team of British researchers decided to follow a group of employees who worked for two different supervisors on alternate days. One they had good rapport with, and one they didn't. In other words, a boss they loved and a Michael Scott. And indeed, on the days the dreaded boss worked, their average blood pressure shot up. A longer 15-year study even found that employees who had a difficult relationship with their boss were 30% more likely to suffer from coronary heart disease. It seems a bad relationship with your boss can be as bad for you as a steady diet of fried foods. And not nearly as much fun. Of all the social ties we have at work, the boss-employee relationship, what Daniel Goleman has cleverly termed a vertical couple, is the single most important social bond you can cultivate at work. Studies have found that the strength of the bond between manager and employee is the prime predictor of both daily productivity and the length of time people stay at their jobs. Gallup, which has spent decades studying the practices of the world's leading organizations, estimates that U.S. companies lose $360 billion each year due to lost productivity from employees who have poor relationships with their supervisor. It is no wonder the vertical couple could have such a profound effect on company performance, given that, as Goleman says, It is a basic unit of organizational life, something akin to human molecules that interact to form the latticework of relationship that is the organization. So when this relationship is strong, companies reap the rewards. Those MIT researchers found that employees with strong ties to their manager brought in more money than those with only weak ties, besting the company average by $588 of revenue each month. And in a study astonishingly large in scope, when Gallup asked 10 million employees around the world if they could agree or disagree with the following statement, "My supervisor or someone at work seems to care about me as a person," those who agreed were found to be more productive, contributed more to profits, and were significantly more likely to stay with their company long-term. The best leaders already know this, and they go out of their way to make employees feel cared for. When a fire destroyed the Malden Mills factory in a small town in Massachusetts, CEO Aaron Feuerstein announced that he would continue to pay the salaries of all 3,000 workers who were suddenly without a job. In their book, In Good Company, Don Cohen and Lawrence Prusak discuss how much this one action shocked the American public. Feuerstein was heralded as a selfless hero, even invited to the White House. But as the authors point out, that the public and the business world would consider Feuerstein's action so extraordinary and apparently unbusinesslike suggests that many people do not yet understand the value of social capital in organizations. The money he spent was an investment in the future of his business. It is clearly in the best interests of everyone involved, the boss, the employee, and the organization as a whole, to prioritize relationships. Unfortunately, in today's harried and fast-paced work environment, far too few leaders put in the time required to forge strong bonds with either their colleagues or their employees. It certainly doesn't require paying everyone's salary. All it takes, we've seen, is a commitment to frequent and positive social interaction. And yet, a recent poll found that 90% of respondents believed workplace incivility was a serious problem. Many leaders simply refuse to put in the effort, and the reasons are many and varied. Not enough hours in the day, a fear of undermining their authority by getting too close to those they manage, a perpetual crisis mode mindset, the woods are on fire, the sky is falling, and even the simple belief that work is for work, not friendship. And yet the more they ignore the power of social investment, the more they undermine both their company's performance and their own. Appreciating assets. Financial planners tell us that the surest way to grow our stock portfolios is to keep reinvesting the dividends. So it is with our social portfolios as well. Not only do we need to invest in new relationships, we should always be reinvesting in our current relationships because, like our stocks, social support networks grow stronger the longer they are held. Fortunately, there is a whole host of techniques we can use to aid us in this endeavor. Every time you cross the office threshold, you have an opportunity to form or strengthen a high-quality connection. When traveling down busy corridors, greet colleagues you cross paths with, and remember to look them in the eye. This isn't just for show. Neuroscience has revealed that when we make eye contact with someone, it actually sends a signal to the brain that triggers empathy and rapport. Ask interested questions, schedule face-to-face meetings, and initiate conversations that aren't always task-oriented. A popular manager at a top 100 law firm once told me that he set out to learn one new thing about a coworker each day, which he would then reference in later conversations. The social capital he invested in each day paid out in increasingly large ways, as employees felt more connected to both him and the firm. Of course, this does take effort on the front end. In an interview with Fast Company, one CEO and former head of a venture capital firm acknowledged that to maximize the value that one gets from a relationship, one has to give a great deal. I spend a fair amount of my time making introductions, providing referrals, providing connections, and generally engaging with the breadth of the community to benefit the business and personal lives of others. We all know that an important part of maintaining a social bond is being there, both physically and emotionally, when someone is in need. But an interesting new body of research suggests that how we support people during good times, more than bad times, affects the quality of a relationship. Sharing upbeat news with someone is called capitalization, and it helps multiply the benefits of the positive event as well as strengthen the bond between the two people involved. The key to gaining these benefits is how you respond to someone's good news. Shelley Gable, a leading psychologist at the University of California, has found that there are four different types of responses we can give to someone's good news, and only one of them contributes positively to the relationship. The winning response is both active and constructive. It offers enthusiastic support as well as specific comments and follow-up questions. That's wonderful. I'm glad your boss noticed how hard you've been working. When does your promotion go into effect? Interestingly, her research shows passive responses to good news, that's nice, can be just as harmful to the relationship as blatantly negative ones. You got the promotion? I'm surprised they didn't give it to Sally. She seems more suited to the job. Ouch. Perhaps the most destructive, though, is ignoring the news entirely. Have you seen my keys? Gable's studies have shown that active, constructive responding enhances relationship commitment and satisfaction, and fuels the degree to which people feel understood, validated, and cared for during a discussion, all of which contribute to the happiness advantage. Building a socially invested team. If you're a leader, you not only have the power to strengthen your own connections, but to foster a work environment that values instead of hinders social investment. For example, when new hires enter an organization, leaders can take the time to introduce them to everyone, even and especially people in other departments with whom they might not be working directly. In fact, why stop there? Existing employees, too, should do all they can to meet others in far-flung corners of the organization. That's why some companies have long-term employees spend one day learning the ropes of a different department. After all, the more chances for employees to meet one another, the more chances they have to forge high-quality connections. And the more buy-in from human resources, the more effective this strategy becomes. So if you're in a leadership position in your company, or even if you're not, simply introducing two employees who don't know each other is probably the easiest and fastest way to invest in social dividends. To be even more effective, the introductions should go beyond just name, department, and job description. Mike Morrison, Vice President and Dean of the University of Toyota, likes to ask employees, "What's on the other side of your card?" In other words, the front of your business card may read Managing Director, but you may better identify with Big Picture Thinker, or Educator, or Calm Under Fire. This kind of information, or even a few simple details like where a person lives, what his or her favorite hobby is, cuts through the red tape to get somewhere more meaningful, and it can more immediately and effectively forge a connection between two people. It is important to note that building strong social capital does not require that all colleagues become best friends or even that everyone like one another all the time. This would be impossible. But what does matter is that there be mutual respect and authenticity. Coercing employees into awkward icebreakers or forced bonding activities, like making everyone at a meeting share something about their private lives, only breeds disconnection and mistrust. Better that these moments happen organically, which they will if the environment is right. The best leaders give their employees the space and time to let moments of social connection develop on their own. So the more physical spaces available to publicly commune, the better. When a CEO of one company saw that some of the best social connections, people laughing, swapping stories about their weekend, bouncing ideas off one another, were taking place on the stairwells, he actually expanded the stairways and put coffee machines on the landings to encourage this practice. Time for team lunches and after-hours socialization is also crucial. Even the classically boring meeting, says Jane Dutton, can be designed in a way to foster high-quality connections. Meeting practices that encourage member contribution and active listening foster group commitment. One of the best managing directors I know makes his meetings BlackBerry-free, so that all eyes are on one another at all times. He is an example of a leader Dutton would call relationally attentive. The more attentive we are to the relationship dynamics of our teams, the better. If our goal is to foster team cohesion, the language you use matters. Remember the difference in group cooperation when a task was termed the community game instead of the Wall Street game? We can promote social connection at work just by using language that implies a common purpose and interdependence. Dutton also recommends that we work on being present, both physically and mentally. That means when somebody walks into your office to talk, don't stare at your computer screen. When someone calls you on the phone, don't keep typing that email. An accountant once told me that the minute he heard a clicking keyboard on the other end of the phone call, he knew his boss was disengaged. Forging a connection requires active listening, giving someone your full attention, and also allowing them to have their say. As Dutton explains, many people listen as if waiting for an opportunity to make their own point. Instead, focus on the speaker and their opinion, and then ask interested questions to learn more. The leaders most committed to social investment also get moving, quite literally. The best way to form more connections at work is to get out from behind the desk. This idea of managing by walking around was popularized in the 1980s by leadership expert Tom Peters, who learned about the practice from the leaders of Hewlett-Packard. Peters even gave it an acronym, MBWA, to signify its importance. MBWA allows managers to get to know employees, share good news and best practices, hear concerns, offer solutions, and deliver encouragement. Jim Kelly, CEO of UPS, is one famous practitioner. "I don't even know the phone numbers of the people on our management committee," he has said, "because I never pick up the phone if they're in the office. We just walk into each other's offices when we need to talk." 25 years after first discussing its role in organizational success, Tom Peters says MBWA is as important as ever and still woefully underused. Connecting with employees face-to-face also provides a perfect opportunity to put into practice a recommendation we talked about earlier in this audio program: frequent recognition and feedback. Not only can it raise a team above the Lasada line, but delivering specific and authentic praise for a job well done also strengthens the connection between two people. This is why I often ask managers to write an email of praise or thanks to a friend, family member, or colleague each morning before they start their day's work. Not just because it contributes to their own happiness, but because it very literally cements a relationship. Whether the thank you is for years of emotional support or for one day of help around the office, expressions of gratitude at work have been proven to strengthen both personal and professional bonds. In fact, studies have shown that gratitude sparks an upward spiral of relationship growth, where each individual feels motivated to strengthen the bond. It also predicts feelings of integration and cooperation within a larger group, which means that the more gratitude one employee expresses towards another employee, the more social cohesion they feel among the whole team. In other words, gratitude can fuel your own identity as a glue guy. Lessons from a fire maze. As I saw when the economy crumbled, sometimes it takes a crisis to teach us the importance of social investment. In a front page story on this phenomenon, the Washington Post reported a marked increase in carpooling and community bonding once the recession hit. People even started holding yard work parties, where neighbors could swap lawnmowers and landscaping advice. As one man noted, people are helping each other and getting back together. You're not the Lone Ranger anymore. Even the executives I work with, people who only months before the recession have been inward-looking, personal results-driven, and intent on going it alone, started espousing and practicing cooperation and teamwork in those dark days after the collapse. Workaholics, with suddenly less on their plate, started coming home earlier to spend more time with their children and spouses. Formerly individualistic managers started leaving the comfort of their offices and making the rounds, cubicle to cubicle. They may have been left no other choice at first, and they might backslide once the economy goes on the upswing again. But many have told me that being forced to re-examine their life and work has ended up being the best thing that could have happened to them. In an ideal world, of course, it shouldn't take a crisis to bring this point home, especially given the wealth of evidence showing that our relationships are the greatest predictor of both happiness and high performance. So even though our basic instincts might tell us to turn inward, positive psychology knows better. When caught in a fire, holding on to others is the best chance we have for successfully finding our way out of the maze. And in everyday life, both at work and at home, our social support can prove the difference between succumbing to the cult of the average and achieving our fullest potential. Part 3. The Ripple Effect. Spreading the happiness advantage at work, at home, and beyond. A couple of months ago, I spoke to a group of CEOs and their spouses in Hong Kong. Afterward, over drinks at a reception, a very self-assured, if slightly tipsy CEO shook my hand warmly and said, "Thank you, Sean. That research was brilliant and rings so true." He then leaned in and whispered conspiratorially, "I already do most of it, but my wife really needed to hear it." His stage whisper was loud enough for everyone in line to hear, and as he gestured to his wife standing 15 feet away, I recognized her as one of the first people I talked to that evening. I smiled and whispered back, equally loudly and conspiratorially, "Thank you, sir. She said the same thing about you." I relate the story not as an example of how to stir up trouble in a perfect stranger's marriage, but to show that no matter where I am in the world, most people think this research is useful for them, but even more useful for all the people around them. The person we have the greatest power to change is ourselves, but while the seven principles must start at the individual level, they by no means end there. To conclude this audio program, I want to talk about how making these changes in ourselves can impact those around us. Once we start capitalizing on the happiness advantage in our own lives, the positive changes quickly ripple out. This is why positive psychology is so powerful. Using all seven principles together sparks an upward spiral of happiness and success, so that the benefits quickly become multiplicative. Then the positive effects begin to ripple outward, increasing the happiness of everyone around you, changing the way your colleagues work, and eventually shaping your entire organization. Spiraling upward. This whole process starts with your brain. As we saw in Principle 6, your thoughts and actions are constantly shaping and reshaping the neural pathways in the brain. This means that the more you practice the exercises outlined in this program, and the more you shift your mindset toward the positive, the more you cement these habits for the long haul. And as your brain becomes more adept at one habit, it improves your ability to capitalize on another. That's because these principles don't work in isolation. I presented them as seven distinct principles for the purpose of clarity. But as you might have already noticed, they're inextricably linked. And using several in concert with one another only enhances their collective power. For instance, the Tetris effect fuels falling up, because training ourselves to scan the world for the positive can help us reinterpret failures as opportunities for growth. And social investment can help us in our quest to master the 20-second rule, since strong social support holds us accountable to new habits. And of course, we can also use the 20-second rule to improve our social investment by decreasing the activation energy required to form high-quality connections at work.